You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Hanging out with Clement
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
It's 8 minutes after 10 o'clock. It's time for the hanging out feature. And today's guest is a politician. She's a mother. Some hate her, some love her. She played a critical role in the growth of the main opposition party in the country, the Democratic Alliance. She was an anti-apartheid activist, a prominent journalist. You would have read and heard of how she helped uncover the truth behind the Black Consciousness Movement leader, Steve Biko's death in the late 70s. Her name is Otta Helen Zilla, and I'm looking forward to you and I getting to know her better. Helen, thanks so much for making time to hang out with me.
Such a pleasure, Clement, and great to be with you today. Thank you.
Can I just say that I was jamming to your playlist last night? So I normally play the songs that the guests send us, and I must say I really enjoyed your songs. But I was surprised that there was no Brenda Fassie there.
Yes, you know, I love Brenda Fassie. I love Brenda Fassie, and she obviously has my theme tune, so we can certainly play that. But these are songs that have meant a lot to me at critical points. Brenda Fassie has, of course, meant a lot to me as well. Vulindlela, Open the Road, has been a great song for me. But I chose my particular songs because they've got lines that are so important. You know, Big Yellow Taxi, you don't know what you've lost till it's gone. Really important line there. Don't worry about a thing because every little thing's going to be all right. I mean, these are great lines. And for me, they've meant a lot at critical points in my life.
Yeah. Scientist by Coldplay is one of the songs you submitted to us. Why is that so important for you?
Well, it is. I think it's a beautiful piece of music. It is a very beautiful piece of music. And there are two different reasons. My son used to play it on the piano and sing it very beautifully as a teenager. And that brings a whole lot of memories back to me. But also, there's this wonderful line. Nobody said it was easy. No one ever said it would be this hard. And, of course, that has come back to me many, many times during my career. Nobody said it would be easy, but nobody said it would be this hard.
All right. Let's listen to that song.
Set you apart. Oh, take me back to the start.
Ah, it's a beautiful song, Helen. It's a beautiful song. Anyway, congratulations on your upcoming book, Stay Woke, Go Broke. You are publishing it later this month, and already I saw that even before its release, it hit number one on Amazon's bestseller list.
Well, these are in categories on Amazon. So Amazon has different categories. And I was interested to see that my publisher had entered me into several categories: constitutions, sociology of race relations, social theory, leadership. And I was really pleased to hit number one on all of those. So that was really great. Yeah.
That's beautiful. What about wokeness are you exploring in this book? I heard you say the other day that it's going to be a controversial book.
It's going to be a very controversial book. But, you know, I like to say I'm Zilla, not vanilla. Nothing about me is vanilla.
Yeah.
And nothing about me is uncontroversial, because the issues in South Africa are so pressing. And I like to look at the current issues from a perspective of 20 years into the future. When we look back, what should we have been asking? What should we have been debating? What issues should we have been foreseeing right now? And that is what I keep asking myself. And I know that this obsession with race and biological identity is going to have very dire effects for South Africa, because it is a smokescreen for all kinds of other agendas: corruption, self-enrichment, power abuse, all of those things. And it's not what it seems to be. And applying the woke ideology that has taken hold of America in South Africa will be the death of our democracy.
Do you think it's a problem, though, to be woke? And you can tell me if you agree with how I have looked at it. And I don't know how you define wokeness, but to me, it's a state of being aware of the social problem. So it could be inequality, it could be racism. And someone said to me that, you know, last night, that wokeness is being delegitimized by some because it's been holding whiteness to account, so to speak. So for the first time ever, because for the longest time, what was challenged was the system of slavery, the system of colonialism, the system of apartheid. Do you agree with that? How have you come to define it? And why do you find it to be problematic?
Well, it was very interesting. My whole second chapter deals with how different people define wokeness. And the very best way of defining it, which is also a very superficial way of defining it, is saying it is being aware of systemic injustice. It goes far deeper than that. And interestingly, in your little definition there, you touched on two elements. Now, I would fundamentally reject the division of people into categories on the basis of their race. You may come to me with a long definition of what whiteness is, but I promise you, in South Africa and in most other countries in the world, whiteness gets translated as whites, all whites, and then it's very quick step to say, well, whites are the problem in South Africa. And once you've said whites are the problem in South Africa, then it is very easy to draw the conclusion that once you've got rid of whites, everything will be fine in South Africa. Now, of course, we all know that that is complete and utter nonsense. We all know that education won't be better if whites were to disappear. There wouldn't be more jobs if whites were to disappear. There wouldn't be better healthcare if whites were to disappear. And moreover, whites are absolutely not the problem. You cannot generalize about an entire category of people on the basis of race. We've had that before in South Africa. It was called apartheid, where whiteness tried to get rid of blackness. And many of us completely opposed that and stood against that and said it is totally unacceptable to generalize and to lump all people on their biological characteristic of the amount of melanin in their skin into one category of persons and then define that as a problem. It is absolutely wrong, and we need to get rid of biological determinism. And so now to be back full circle into biological determinism is a very, very sad day for South Africa.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading the book. I'm looking forward to you when you publish it later this week, and hopefully we'll read it and engage it further on the show about some of the points that you make. Speak to us about your childhood. You grew up in Hillbrow, hey?
No, I didn't grow up there. I was born there.
You were born there.
I didn't grow up there. I grew up in the countryside, and believe it or not, back then, Rivonia was the countryside.
Rivonia?
It was certainly not a posh northern suburb as it is today. It was small holdings. We grew up opposite a peach orchard. The house that my parents had was very, very modest. My parents were both refugees from Germany, and my dad literally took my mother out to this little plot of land where there was a shack on it. You know, I've still got photos of growing up in a house with corrugated iron walls. And over the years, my father built it into a brick and mortar house, a proper brick and mortar house. It was still a very strange house because he didn't have any architectural guidance or anything like that. So we grew up in a kind of higgledy-piggledy house that had all been put together in little and different ways. But it was very fine. It was a loving home. And we grew up very happily in a simple village with ordinary people.
I'm interested in the story that you tell. I read your book, you know, the last book, you know, that you released, Not Without a Fight.
Not Without a Fight.
Yeah, and you tell a story in your book, especially in the early pages, of your parents who left Germany, was it in the 1930s, to avoid Nazi persecution. What impact have those stories had on the young Helen Ziller growing up in Rivonia at the time, and how, even when she was older, she started to view the world?
Interestingly, I got most of the stories that I know about Nazi Germany from my mother, because my father never spoke about it. Excuse me. And my father's family lost far more than my mother's family, actually, through Nazi persecution. My father's mother was Jewish, And my father lost 12 direct relatives, cousins, aunts, uncles, in the death camps of Europe, in the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. So my father lost very many relatives in the Holocaust, but he never ever spoke about it. My mother, on the other hand, spoke a lot about it. Her mother was not Jewish, but her father was.
Mm-hmm.
And their house was destroyed on Kristallnacht, and a whole range of other devastating influences on her life. And she spoke to me a lot about that. And the impact that it had on us as a family was my parents could not bear any kind of social or racial or religious discrimination. We grew up in a house that was absolutely committed to fairness, to equality, to equity. And my parents always exhibited that. Our parents were always very politically aware and politically involved. They always spoke to us about politics, which was very important. My mother was one of the very early members of the Black Sash and was all her years that I can recall. My father was a member of the Torch Commando and then always worked in elections against the National Party all the years and joined the Progressive Party as soon as it broke away from the United Party. So that was my childhood home, very aware of injustice. And my mother was very bold in standing up against it, I must say, and my father supported her.
It's interesting because then you were aware from a young age. Is that why you ended up being a journalist?
I think so. I was always very interested in journalism. My father used to drive me to school. It was a long 12-kilometer drive. He used to buy the newspaper, and he used to then make me read it. And I was always fascinated by reading the newspaper for my father. He used to discuss the political events. We used to read the Rand Daily Mail every morning. And I once said to him, I'd love to be a journalist for the Rand Daily Mail. And then I went on to become one. So it was really lovely.
That's
the fulfillment of my childhood dream.
Yeah. So your views of the apartheid government were clear at the time. I mean, you know, being a white anti-apartheid activist, I'm interested in the dynamics that happened. I interviewed I've interviewed Tandeka, the artist, you know, because she used to sing a lot. DJ Powers, she sang a lot about apartheid. She sang a lot about the need for us to come together. And she told me that it was really hard to be an activist, anti-apartheid activist, and you are white, because the treatment that she got from not only her family, but some of her friends was quite harrowing. How was that for you as an anti-apartheid activist during apartheid?
Well, I always had the support of my family, so that wasn't a problem at all.
Mm.
The community was a bit suspicious of us, I suppose, as a family, but my mother was strong enough to stand up against it. And yes, it got difficult at times. It really did get difficult, especially when I was doing a lot of journalistic exposés, as you mentioned at the beginning. There were the death threats and things like that, but I want to tell you, it was easier for me personally to be anti-apartheid then than it is to take on the ANC and the new form of racism today. I get much more hate today than I got then.
You think?
Yes.
Mm. Why do you think that is the case?
I don't know. I've often thought about it. Let me just venture a guess.
Mm.
Even back then, around the world, being anti-apartheid gave you the moral high ground. So it was a moral and a good and a right thing to be anti-apartheid. And even though many white South Africans may have given you the cold shoulder, you knew that you were on the right side of history. Today, for some strange reason, even though the ANC has lost the moral high ground, it has somehow become progressive to accept racial categorization as a good thing rather than a bad thing. Back in my day, it was globally seen as a bad thing to racially categorize people and define them according to labels. And so opposing that was easier. Today, for some strange and incomprehensible reason, the very philosophy that underpinned apartheid is seen to be progressive. And I am consistent in opposing that, which is why I get a lot of hate. And I get a lot of hate on platforms such as social media, of course, which it didn't exist back then. So it's quite hard today, and you get marginalized and have had a lot of, hate directed at. Well, how else can I explain it? And far more than I actually had back then. That's the irony of it. It's far, far harder today to be anti the race categorization than it was then. Mm. Of course, let me quickly say that I was never arrested. Well, I was arrested. But I was never detained without trial and things like that. So I would quickly add that if I had been detained without trial or tortured, I might have a very different view of it. And that did not happen to me. I was arrested, but I was never detained without trial.
Yeah. Do you not think that, because what you're saying is you're hated, like you're being shown more hate now than at the time. And I wonder if it's not because of maybe the things that you have said that have offended people. For instance, your black privilege tweets, where you said black privilege means looting and being reelected. When you said that there were more racist laws in South Africa than apartheid, when you tweeted, celebrating the positive aspects of colonialism, those were the tweets that you were suspended for from the party activities because of that comment. Do you not think that it's because perhaps of some of the comments you've made that have offended people, and that is why they've responded in the way that they continue to on your social media?
I've always made comments that offended people. I've always written things that have offended people. No one has a right not to be offended. Freedom means the right to speak freely. And often when you're telling the truth, it profoundly offends people. But that is why you have a free country. That is why hate speech is so narrowly defined, because everyone in pursuing the truth is going to offend people. There's no question about that. Now, you've got to look at all of those tweets in the context of the discussions that were going on in the time. You can't decontextualize them and take them as if they were not part of a conversation. I mean, when everyone's battering me about white privilege, I say, well, if you're battering me about white privilege, let me tell you what black privilege is. And that was at the time when Jacob Zuma was quite clearly looting the country and had got reelected. And I said, that's an absolute privilege for all your electorate to actually know that you're looting the country and to reelect you. That's some kind of privilege. And if you want to generalize about all whites, and if we then generalized around black people, that would be the conclusion, wouldn't it? That is a rational argument. So you can't take that out of context. You have to look at the context of generalizing about white privilege and say, well, if you want to generalize about all whites on the basis of one or two whites, let's then start that with black people and see how you feel. Let's start taking one or two black people and generalize that across the entire category and see how inappropriate it was. So the entire point of that tweet was to say, generalizing about all people on the basis of an example of one is wrong. And that was the point of that tweet.
But do you fix it wrong? Do you fix it wrong with the wrong? Because on your version, you're saying, if you believe that people have been generalizing about white people, either when they talk about white privilege or whiteness as a political definition, and you come in, you say, well, let me tell you about blackness. That's you basically saying what you're doing is wrong, but I will give you your own taste of your medicine. Here's what's also wrong, but it doesn't really help. It's you're trying to fix a wrong with a wrong.
No, it actually exposes the wrong. Because the minute you say this is black privilege, black people get outraged. They say we don't all steal and we don't all loot and we don't all get reelected. And then I say, well, exactly. If you're saying that you can't generalize about white people, I'm saying you can't generalize about black people either. And you see, that's how I'm going to expose the logical fallacy of your argument.
Do you think you're misunderstood? You know, I was saying earlier that one of the things I wanted to ask you is, because as you say, you've always offended people, right? Do you like controversy? Do you like stirring things up? Or are you just misunderstood?
Well, I like to stand up for what I believe is true. And I like to expose hypocrisy. And I don't like double standards. And I like fairness and equality. And if I'm going to oppose apartheid and racial generalizations about black people, then I'm going to oppose racial generalizations about white people. I'm consistent. And I don't like double standards. And I don't like dishonesty. And I don't like hypocrisy.
Mm.
And that stirs things up, absolutely.
Yeah. Helen, the listeners that want to call in, I see messages are coming through as well. I don't want to be selfish and have you all to myself. I'm going to be taking some calls on 011-883-0702. If you have a comment or you want to ask Helen Ziller a question, we are hanging out with her.
Hanging out with Clement on 702. Let's walk the talk.
It's 25 minutes before 11 o'clock. This is the Hanging Out feature. And today I've got Helen Ziller, the DA Federal Council Chair, who's hanging out with us. We're getting to know her better. I see a lot of you, like you said, Helen, you've always offended people. There are people that are responding to some of the comments you've made. And I'm going to read some of the messages. I'll take some calls on 011-883-0702. If you want to talk about you've worked with Helen or you want to talk about the work that she's done in the DA, you're very much welcome to give us a call. Let's start with the voice notes that are coming on 072-702-1702.
Hi, Helen Zille. It's Lesita in Tembisa. Please, Helen, just tell me, what do you think about all these Mickey Mouse political parties? We have a lot of political parties in South Africa which are not helping the voters. Don't you think we must have at least 3 or 4 political parties instead of 15, 20 political parties? And some of these political parties, they just appear before the elections and they divide the voters. Do you think having these political parties will ever help in toppling the ANC? Lesetja in Tembisa.
All right, Lesetja, thank you so much for your voice note. Let's hear another one.
Good morning, Clement and your crew. I'm looking forward to hear more about Helen Ziller than the politics sides of Helen Ziller. So hopefully you'll keep this interview straight and more the personal side more than the politics. And every side, who's Helen Ziller, where she grew up, and all other those kind of things. So can you please try so hard to keep it in her personal side of story, her growing ups and all that stuff. So,
yeah.
No politics, please, just for one day.
Well, if you listened to at the beginning of the show, you would have heard that we spoke about where Helen Ziller grown up. And I'll speak to you about the family as well. Look. If you've listened to the show before, you know the Hanging Out feature is about getting to know the people I invite on the guests. It's not an accountability interview. Sometimes, I mean, there's things that Helen has said during the interview that I disagree with, but I don't also want to be spending the next 20 minutes where it's a back and forth where I say, I disagree with this, and then she comes and says, this is my point. I want you to get to know Helen Ziller. And we'll invite her again. We'll invite her again on the show and have her for an hour where we talk politics. But this is the Hanging Out feature, and you're right. We do get to know her better. But I also don't want to censor you. If you've got a question about what she said, please feel free to send us an SMS. Helen, I'll give you an opportunity to answer that first question about the so-called Mickey Mouse political parties. Is it better to have like 4 political parties instead of the many political parties that we have? But let me play this last voice note, and then I'll give you a chance to respond.
Hi, Clement. Please ask Mrs. Ziller if she could choose one political opposition to go in a public debate with, whether it be EFF or ANC, who would it be and why?
Oh, interesting question. So, Helen, 2 questions. One about the so-called Mickey Mouse political parties. Is it better to have a few than a lot of political parties? The second question is, if you would choose one leader of a party that you'd go on a debate with, who would it be? Would it be the EFF, the ANC, which leader and why?
Well, I would clearly debate the ANC because I would believe that Cyril Ramaphosa owes the country a lot of explanations for a lot of things, for his inactivity, for his indecisiveness. It's very clear what needs to be done on many, many issues. And I would challenge him as to why it's not happening. For example, we've had many commissions. Extraordinary evidence has been led with documentary backing, and all of the evidence is there to lead major court cases before the courts. And I would want to know why that isn't happening and where the accountability is that he has spoken about for so long. So I would very much like to have a debate with the president around what he is doing to fulfill his mandate under the Constitution and why he is so silent about many of those crucial things. So that's the answer to that first question. The Secha asked a very important question. He said, well, don't I think all the tiny little parties are dividing the electorate and making it difficult to hold the ANC to account? Well, it is very difficult when opposition voters divide their vote into many, many tiny little parties that are ineffectual. Many of them just spring up before the election. Many of them end up with one or two people. But this is a free country, and people must be able to form political parties and vote for political parties as they see fit. Unfortunately, in local government elections, as we have coming up later this year, in a local government election, one person who's elected in one tiny party, as Lesetja says, can hold the balance of power. And then you get into government with very, very shaky coalitions. And then voters wonder why the government is so unstable and why delivery is so difficult under that kind of government. Well, the answer is because the voters keep dividing the votes amongst all the tiny little opposition parties that then requires us to put together these very complex and unstable coalitions to put ourselves in government, which means unstable government that finds it very difficult to deliver on the basic mandate. So people must understand, you either want to vote for the ANC because you don't mind corruption and you don't mind decline, or you want to vote for change and a good alternative. And obviously the DA is the only alternative. But if people want to scatter their votes amongst all sorts of tiny little parties for whatever personal reasons they may have, well, then sadly, they've just got to live with the consequences because they choose their government. In a democracy, people get the government that the majority voted for. And even if that is a shaky, complex coalition government, that is what the voters chose.
At what point did you decide it's time to go into politics, Helen? Was that ever an intention? Was it accidental?
It was entirely accidental, Clement. I was never going to go into politics. In fact, at that time, I was director of communications at the University of Cape Town. And I was really enjoying that job and doing it to the very best of my ability. But I was also a chairperson of the governing body of the Grove Primary School, where my children were. They were in primary school at the time. And they were growing up there, and we were really integrating that school and doing everything we could to comply with all of the vision of the new South Africa. I've been very involved behind the scenes in commenting on the new South African Schools Act. And the first thing the government did was violate its own act with a voluntary severance package and redeployment scheme. And then as the chair of a governing body, I took the department, the education department, to court. And we won that court case, and we won it on appeal. So we won that court case. It was a very important landmark court case. And after that, Tony Leon asked me if I wouldn't look at the DA's education policy and comment on it. And I did, and I said, this isn't a very good policy. And then he asked me to rewrite it, which I then did. Mm-hmm. And having rewritten it, he asked me to throw my hat in the ring for a place on the DA's list in the Western Cape, which I then did. I got interviewed. I got number 6 on the DA's, or the DP's list, as it was then, the DP's list. And then I was elected very much on the remainder, just on the edge. And we had the balance of power in the Western Cape province in the legislature. And I became the Minister of Education in 6 months from not having been involved in politics at all, through a completely accidental request, I suppose, by Tony Leon for me to go over the DP's education policy. I ended up as the provincial minister of education in a matter of 6 months, which was amazing.
And your record of leadership in the DA is well documented. I mean, you helped the party grow. You helped it grow even in black communities as well. Do you, upon reflection, when you left the position of DA leader, what regrets do you have? if any, about your time as the leader of the DA?
Well, the bottom line is that you do what you think is best when you do it. And I've always done things after some serious consideration and reflection about the alternatives. And the big question in politics is always compared to what? You may not take the best decision, but compared to all the other alternatives you had in that context, it may have been the best that you could have done at the time in that context. So obviously I have a few regrets. My main regrets have been that I wasn't at all the sports events and other important events for my children. I tried to be the most present mother I could in the circumstances, because you will remember, Clement, that I was also mayor and leader at the same time, and then I was premier and leader at the same time. And those things were very, very challenging. I have a wonderful husband, so he was always there to fill in for me at critical moments, and I couldn't ever have done it without him. And I've got two wonderful sons who really were very strongly independent and stood on their own two feet, which I really am grateful for. But I regret that I wasn't a more present mother.
Hmm. And taking Musi Maimane under your wing, backing him as the first leader of the party in 2015, do you regret that?
No, I don't. I thought at the time, and with all the information that I had at the time, I thought that Musi was the absolute right fit. He was young, very telegenic, very charismatic. He could deliver a speech far better than I could, far, far better than I could. And I really felt in the context of the time, we needed the alternative to Julius Malema. I saw the ANC coming apart, as I still see it coming apart. I think it will disintegrate over the next 10, 15 years completely. And politics will be a contest between the EFF and the DA. And I felt if we really needed a strong alternative to the racial nationalist populism and anti-constitutionalism of the EFF, what we needed was a young, dynamic, charismatic person who believed in non-racialism, who believed in constitutionalism, who believed in the rule of law. He was perfectly qualified. He had a degree in business administration and a degree in theology.
Mm.
In fact, a master's degree in both. So he has a double master's degree, which makes him far, far more qualified than I am. And I just felt he was the right fit. You know, his whole life spoke of non-racialism. His personal life spoke of non-racialism. All of those things. And I really genuinely thought he was the perfect fit.
So you don't think he was an experiment gone wrong like Tony Leon has suggested?
Well, no human being is ever an experiment. I believe that every human being is on earth for a reason, and that we have to find our purpose and live our purpose. But if you look at my life, you will see what a big experiment I was for the DA. I mean, they put me in as the mayoral candidate. I was then in charge of a very complex 7-party coalition, and that was really difficult to run. And then at the same time, they made me the leader of the party. Now, that was a massive experiment. I don't think the DA ever viewed me personally as an experiment, because no human being, as I said, is an experiment. But they viewed having a mayor as a leader concurrently as a huge experiment, as a risk, as a trial run that could easily have gone wrong. And you make lots of those decisions, those experimental decisions in politics, to see if they will pay off or not. So no human being is ever an experiment.
Mm, okay. I have to ask you this last question about the DA before we move to your family, and I'll take a break and then go to the lines as well and play some voice notes. You're now the party's federal council chair. You came back to active politics, and since your return, an argument can be made that things have just been crumbling down for the DA. You have many senior leaders and other members who were working for the party leaving the organization. Musi, Hemen, Fuzile, Paul Bowie, John, and many others. Are you the reason for that? Or was that just a coincidence that upon your return, these people started feeling this is not the party we identify with anymore?
Well, it's very funny, but when I was the leader, they all identified with the party. I played a key role in recruiting Herman. Everybody knows I played a key role in Musi's rise up the ranks. I was one of the people who appointed Paul Bowie. They were very, very happy being here when I was here. But when things started unraveling so badly for the party, as it did in the run-up to the 2019 election, and when the party's federal council decided to vote me back in to fix it, they knew when I came in to fix it, I was serious about fixing it, and that they couldn't continue playing their little manipulative games and doing their other, let me put this carefully, their other sideshows, as it were. So they knew that I was going to come in and pull the reins very tightly and get things going again, and they preferred to leave. That's fine by me. We asked Musi to stay. He didn't want to. I don't force anybody to do anything they don't want to. People must shape their lives and get on with it.
Okay, let's take a quick ad break. When we come back, I'll go to your calls and your voice notes. It's 10 minutes before 11.
Hanging out with Clement on 702. Let's walk the talk.
It's 8 minutes before 11 o'clock. I see some of your questions coming through. Helen, someone wants to know, Kingsbu on Twitter says, does she regret kissing Mampele Rampele, figuratively speaking? Do you regret that kiss?
Well, if it was the actual kiss, you know, Mampele and I have been friends for years and years and years. And we were friends. We raised our children together. I looked after her children. She had my children over to sleep at her house and vice versa. We've been friends for years. We raised children together. That makes one kind of strong friends. Look, I do regret trying. Well, you know, she approached me. This is the irony. People approach me and they say, you know, I'm ready to join the DA. I'd like to. And then I tried to make it easier. And I offered her the presidential candidacy and stood down from that myself and did all kinds of things to make it easier for her. And then she decided to go another route, which made it very difficult for me. So obviously I do regret how that played out, no question about that, but I don't regret any friendships. I was enriched by all my friendships.
Well, you're not interfering though when you did, because you're saying you did things to make it easier for her. Were you not interfering because now she's your friend and you're trying to...
I never played outside the rules.
Mm.
I never played outside the rules. I didn't impose anything, let's say, on the federal executive. I just argued the case in the federal executive. And I argued why we should do things in a certain way. And then other people opposed me and other people supported me. That's how it works in a democratic organization. I couldn't manipulate the systems. You can't in the DA. And if you try, you'll get thrown out.
Mm. How has your family been handling your job as a politician and the consequences that have come with that over the years?
Well, that is the area that I'm most blessed. Because it's very, very hard for a husband and very hard for children to have to live in the context with a mother who is as controversial as I am and a wife who is as controversial as I am. Now, fortunately, I've got an incredibly steady, committed, loving husband who's been with me now for 38 years of our marriage. And he's never once wavered. He hasn't always agreed with me, but he's never ever once wavered in his support for me and his commitment to me. And he's been like a rock behind the scenes in the most difficult of times, for which I am truly deeply grateful. I have two sons who are independent, who've charted their own life. They keep a million miles away from politics. They don't like it at all. I make sure they vote every election because I think that that is everybody's basic fundamental duty, to go out and vote, because that is what many people fought and died for in this country. But my children, my one is involved in mathematics and statistics. He did a degree in applied statistics at UCT, and he loves his maths, and he does that all the time. And I've got another one who is very involved in online marketing and communication, and that's what he likes. So I've got two boys who've charted their own lives. We're a very loving family. And, of course, the cherry on the top is I have two beautiful grandchildren.
Do they ever feel neglected? Because one of the things you said you regret is not attending, you know, their soccer matches and spending a lot of time with them, because you were premier of the Western Cape, you were leader of the party. So your time was being consumed by politics and your work in that space. Have you spoken it through with them? Did they actually feel that way?
The amazing thing is that my sons have never felt neglected. I don't know whether that was because my husband was always there. He was a professor at University of Cape Town. And at one time, we had a very difficult balancing act because he was head of the department and I was doing all my things. And we were trying to be available parents. My husband was there often when I wasn't, but my children felt, say, tell me, they felt that I was always there when they needed me. And it is true that when they used to call me or phone or need me, I would drop everything and go and be with them, whatever it was. But I couldn't always be there for the fun things, but I was there for all of the challenges and problems.
Yeah.
And that was where my strength as a parent came through.
I've actually never met your husband, Professor Johann Marie, but he looks really quiet and reserved. I imagine you are the most spoken one in the family.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. We're very complementary characters. He is a very, very warm, loving, gentle person. And I'm more outgoing and more, I suppose, confrontational. So we have very different personalities, but we complement each other. And as my little boy said to me when he was 5 years old, he asked me, he said, "Mommy, why does everybody like Daddy, but not everybody likes you?"
Yeah.
And I had explained to him why.
I wonder what the explanation was. Did you say, "Little son, my son, I love offending people"?
I didn't say that. I don't love offending people. I like standing up for the truth. I don't like offending people at all, but I feel very sorry when the truth, in my view, offends people.
Yeah.
However, the bottom line is that I said, you know, Dad has got a job of work to do where he helps people all the time. He's a professor. He teaches students. He's helpful and supportive to them. He supervises their theses and all of that. And that is a very loving, supportive kind of job.
Mm.
My job is to confront people. That's my job.
Mm.
I'm in politics. I'm in opposition politics. My job is to challenge the government on things and to hold them accountable. And people don't like that. So I have a job doing things that people don't like.
Yeah.
And Dad has a job doing things that people do like.
So yeah.
That's how I do.
Okay. Helen, we're out of time. Thank you so much for making time to hang out with us. I really appreciate it. And I think we'll have you again some other time so we can talk more about some of the things you explore in your book. And then the listeners can have an opportunity to also engage with you. I would like to engage with you on some of the things we touched on today. So I hope you'll give us another hour of your time.
I'd love to, Clement. It's been a great, great pleasure being with you. And thanks for asking me some tough questions. And I hope that when you've read my next book, which is Stay Woke, Go Broke, a very controversial title already. So I'm about to get cancelled again. But then we can have another nice conversation.
Okay. We'll put up some time. You're going to be releasing the book. I'll read the book and then we'll bring you back on the show. Thanks, Helen.